Another busy show on Thursday, July 30th, right here on Connecticut Today. Our security expert, Brian Boyd, checked in the 3 o'clock hour to talk about news that some Wisconsin-area law enforcement officers are now refusing to work security for the upcoming Democratic National Convention. We aired portions of Governor Ned Lamont's coronavirus briefing at the 4 o'clock hour, dealing mostly with how to get schools open again in Connecticut amid COVID-19. And former Democratic Bridgeport State Rep Chris Caruso joined us top of the 5 o'clock hour to give us the very latest again on the status of Bridgeport's Christopher Columbus statue. 30-year-plus professional intelligence analyst and counterterrorism specialist, former U.S. Green Beret, part of the leadership of the Joint Special Operations Command, which oversees the Special Forces, SEAL Team 6, and the Delta Force. He also served in the Departments of Defense, Justice, Treasury, and regularly appears all over the country discussing these matters. Check it out, BoydIntelligence.com, B-O-I-D, intelligence.com. Brian Boyd, Paul Pacelli, back here on WICC. How are you, sir?
Good to hear your voice again, Paul. Are you having an eventful week?
Oh, it's the best, Brian. Well, of course, eventful for me is getting up out of bed and being able to walk to the bathroom. So that's, you know, that's where I start on Monday morning, my friend. Let's talk about a couple of things here. First, the word here, it's kind of a story. Interesting, Brian. It kind of flew under the radar here. You've had 100 police and security forces here apparently saying we want nothing to do with providing security next month in Milwaukee for the Democratic National Convention. They claim they're hamstrung, Brian. What do you make of that?
Well, I read that, too, and what you have to sort of understand is that there is a civilian oversight commission, not experts in history of law enforcement or riots in our country, and they, as a commission, told the police chief, Morales, that he cannot, he's restricting tear gas and pepper spray in any kind of demonstrations. Now, he's doing it, they're doing it partially because they've seen it around the country. And there's allegations of abuse. Well, tear gas has been around a long time. It came along after water cannons used to be used. And, of course, that had a bad connotation in Selma and things like that. But it's completely legal to use tear gas and rubber bullets because it's non-lethal. It's been around a long time. The courts have allowed the police to use it. But this Civilian Oversight Commission has stepped in and told the police chief of Milwaukee, you can't use it. Well, all the police chiefs that were donating officers, there's like 100 different agencies. Each were going to donate 4, 5, 6, 10 people so they don't deplete their forces in order to staff up 1,000 police officers to provide security at the convention. Well, if the officers can't use tear gas, all of these police chiefs have written letters to Chief Morales saying, we cannot ensure the safety of the public if we can't use tear gas or things like that to disperse unruly, non-peaceful crowds. And it would also endanger the lives of the police officers. So you have to kind of look at it from that standpoint of view. If you're a police officer, you're being pelted with rocks and stuff, what are you supposed to do, hold a shield up? It doesn't make sense. And so they are apologizing, but they say because of the restrictions in Milwaukee, they cannot condone, or they can't provide police officers because they can't guarantee the safety of their own police officers, much less the public, with that kind of restriction.
And Brian, one thing I don't understand is, and you and I get this, and cops I've talked to get this, say, well, like you said, if we're getting pelted with stuff or threatened with weapons, then the fact that we can't use pepper spray or tear gas or rubber bullets, doesn't that mean that we more likely are going to use a real live round of ammunition when maybe we shouldn't be doing it?
Well, that's not the scenario that anybody really wants to see. You know, we've had long histories of live rounds being abused. You remember Kent State where a guardsman stuck a real bullet in his gun. We've had these concerns where police officers they don't want to use guns. That's where the taser came about as a secondary weapon. Now a police officer has a gun on one hip and a taser gun on the other. And now they've resorted to taser guns as opposed to real guns. And obviously that has helped not killing a lot of suspects. But a policeman needs something in order to protect himself or protect the people around him. He's not supposed to pull a gun on anybody unless he's an actual threat of his life or saving a life, or he's an effecting arrest with an armed person. Otherwise, they're not supposed to pull it out of their holster. We all know that. I had a private security company, and we were telling them, do not pull it out of your holster no matter what.
Hmm. Yeah.
Security people are not protected, see? But the other thing is that from what I was reading, the convention itself is going to be scaled down to maybe 300 people.
Yeah.
It's going to be a virtual event. So it may be a non-problem if there's only going to be 300 attendees. You know, that's smaller than a small high school. I mean, most high schools got four times.
Yeah,
that about.
Yeah, but again, you don't know who's going to be outside these venues. I mean, they'll find out, you know. Yeah, it's on Zoom, but we know certain people are here and certain people are there, though. So I'm sure, Brian, that's a consideration as well.
Yeah, the other thing is one of the articles that I read, they said that they're considering the possible use of the Minnesota National Guard or federal people. Well, that goes over, that oversteps the bounds there because the National Guard can't be brought up. The state controls the National Guard, not the federal government. The state
yeah.
does. So the governor could do that if he chooses to. But again, using federal people is outside their jurisdiction, as we're already witnessing in Portland.
Yeah, and Brian, hang on. I do want to come back to that. That'll be the next part of the interview here as to what's going on in Portland and Seattle and these places and who those actual people are and what are they licensed and empowered to do and not to do. Brian, hang on. Brian Boyd is the guest. We've had him on numerous times before. He's our go-to guy for security, policing, military actions, and all that. Traffic and weather together at 3:36 on WICC. All right, one more segment, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Our security expert, Brian Boyd, check out his thoughts and some of his writings at BoydIntelligence.com, BoydIntelligence.com. Brian, you touched on, I guess, something that's been eased off now a bit in Portland, but there's still going to be a small presence there, Portland, Seattle. In an effort to, the feds are saying, and the White House is saying, protect federal buildings, courthouses, FBI buildings. These federal, I don't know what you would call them, Brian. They were brought in, federal forces in full camo with some pretty heavy armament in this to, you know, guard those buildings and dissuade the rioters. Oh, Brian, who exactly are those people? Where do they come from? I know they're talked about as Homeland Security personnel, but who are the people actually holding those weapons and trying to fend off the rioters and the anarchists from those federal buildings?
Well, it's a conglomerate of agencies. The Department of Homeland Security, which is a relatively new creation in the last half dozen years or so as a result of 9/11 and other things, is an umbrella agency that can borrow or use other agencies like ICE. They can use DEA, they can use ATF, other federal agencies with other federal jurisdictions, and bring them together as a pool of federally duly sworn federal agents who have the right to arrest people under federal law. They cannot usurp and do civilian law. They can't do DUI stops. They can't do traffic stops. They can only enforce federal law. And federal law is limited to protecting federal buildings. Lafayette Square, we can go there if you want to come back to that. But in the Portland condition and Seattle,
yeah,
they were sent there to protect the buildings well after the riots and the stuff started. Now, the mayor there and the other politicians are there trying to shift blame and try to blame the Trump administration or the federal guys. They're federal cops. And they're there to do a job. They're there to protect the building. I watched the attorney general's testimony before the Nadler Judiciary Committee that day, and he made it perfectly clear. There was three elements to this thing. There are legitimate protesters out there that are upset. That's okay. We have a right to protest under our Constitution. The second group of people is a whole bunch of people out of work, out of church, out of school, with nothing to do, who want to go to a huge party, not to make a pun there. But the real problem are violent rioters, criminals, and professional anarchists who have hijacked legitimate protests. And they're there strictly to wreak havoc, to loot, burn, and destroy. And they tend to push the legitimate protesters to the front. They're the ones getting injured, while the guys in the back are lobbing stuff at the cops over the fence. But the cops are barricaded in there. The federal agents are barricaded. And they have a fence erected, and their job is simply to be in a siege thing. It's a little bit like the Alamo. I hate to use the analogy, but they're being under siege. They're not out there running around and chasing people. If they are affecting arrest, they're affecting arrest based on either a warrant or identification where they can pick the people up. They're not out there arresting protesters. They have to arrest people for doing something like destroying the statue or something like that.
So if they see somebody, Brian, you know, lob a Molotov cocktail and it hits a federal building, there, a courthouse or whatever, they can't arrest that person, right?
That's correct, because that's their jurisdiction. And one of the things that it goes back to our Constitution, we're talking about Washington and the federal troops, the Whiskey Rebellion, things like that, a lot of historical things. But the federal troops are not there to replace or supplant state and local. They're in a very precarious situation. The Portland police want to work with normal federal cops. The cooperation in law enforcement has been pretty good the last few years, state and local task forces. I did several task forces in some of my careers. But the problem is the Portland police are being hamstrung by their politicians. And even if you were to suddenly withdraw the federal agents out of the building and say, okay, Portland, it's your jurisdiction, or the state police of Oregon, guess what would happen? They would burn the building down. Because the Portland police are being prohibited by enforcing the law, too. So they can't even protect the building, whether it's their jurisdiction or the feds move out and the building will go down. And, you know, it's sort of a catch-22.
Yeah, the feds are you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Yeah.
That's right. And they're being provoked into it. And when Trump made his comments yesterday about if they can't clean up the city and we'll send in federal people to do it, that's a bit bellicose. I'm not going to disagree with how he feels about it. I know he's frustrated, but he's limited on what he can do. He signed an executive order to make statue destruction in buildings. Well, that gives him a little bit better jurisdiction to keep people from beheading Christopher Columbus on the square. But it's, again, it's kind of not a real thing for the federal guys to do this. And as far as the way they're dressed, they're dressed in protective gear. They're not prepared for combat. They're not carrying machine guns and stuff like military. They do look a little bit like military because SWAT teams look like that.
Yeah.
And any police department or federal agent wearing riot gear looks that way. So I just think the media is making it worse than it really is.
Yeah, and we're in a very tense time. Brian, as always, great stuff. We appreciate it. Brian Boyd, check out his website, folks, BoydIntelligence.com. Brian, you take care of yourself. Good to hear from you again, and we'll check in down the road. Thanks.
Yes, sir. Nice talk to you, Paul.
Thanks, Brian. Be good. Brian Boyd there from down in Florida, down in FLA. Brian Boyd, 30-plus year professional intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, former Green Beret, part of the leadership of Joint Special Ops Command, overseeing SEAL Team 6, Special Forces, and Delta Force.
That's a lot. That's a universe of 150,000 in a week. Sadly, six more fatalities, and it's just incredible that we just passed a benchmark of 150,000 COVID-related deaths in the United States in the last, 12 hours. Remember, we thought it might be 60,000. We'd be doing well at 80. It's going on, and it's continuing, and it's accelerating in a number of states. Our hospitalizations, 13 plus 13. I know when to worry at this point, and this does not worry me in the sense that the number of people being admitted to our hospitals has been flat. It is not going up. So the fact that we have 13 more people hospitalized just means there weren't as many people, you know, exiting the hospitals. So I think we're in good shape on that front. The next chart, do you have that, Max? Is reopening of the schools. And I just wanted to talk to you about that a little bit. As you know, when it comes to reopening of everything we've done in the state of Connecticut, it's been focused on public health, That's been priority number one, two, and three for us, has been public health. And that's why we've had Dr. Koh taking the lead. That's why we had Scott Gottlieb here a week ago. That's why Zeke Emanuel is here. And so we're going to talk a little bit about reopening now as regards our schools. And I think it's pretty timely that Zeke is here, because he just had his op-ed piece in the New York Times yesterday, I think it was, Zeke, that was entitled, "Opening Schools is Not Easy, but Here's How to Do It Safely." I think that's fairly timely, given this has been our focus over the last couple of weeks as we figure out how we can reopen schools safely. Just as a reminder, we're setting out some rules as we got all the information back from superintendents across the state. We've had a week to digest that. We're now going back. I've had a chance to talk to superintendents and teachers and students. And number one, we're going to be having the superintendents and the local district leaders determine what the mix is between full-time, in-person classroom and a hybrid experience back and forth. And I think that will be clearer in a second. It'll be guided by the metrics, the county-based public health metrics, the same metrics that we've been describing every day as we talk about what we're doing in terms of our COVID-related numbers. And we'll do that on a county basis. I'd love to hear Zeke's thought on that. We've got five counties here in the state, these congressional districts. We'll be doing that on a county basis, give a little bit of flexibility to those local leaders going forward. We'll be updating the metrics on a weekly basis. So, for example, if there's a spike in infections, there's a surge in hospitalizations, at that point, we're going to be in a strong position to change course and, get people in a different type of educational environment. So right now, the metrics indicate we can have classroom experience in class as well as a mix of hybrid. If there are any schools, for example, that say, I just want to do full distance learning no matter what the metrics indicate, at that point, we will you go to our superintendent or go to our commissioner of education and seek an exception for some unique reasons. But right now, the metrics indicate we're going to have a mix of in-classroom, particularly for the lower grades, as well as the hybrid, more likely in the upper grades where it's tougher to cohort. Let me tell you in the next slide why I think nothing replaces the classroom. And we've heard this in all of our surveys. Look, nobody's making a bigger commitment to distance education than the state of Connecticut. We have just acquired now well over 100,000 Chromebooks to make sure that no kid is left behind, no kid is on the wrong side of the digital divide. We're getting those distributed to those young people most in need. Secondly, as you probably heard, we talked about it the last couple of days, we're going to have the Wi-Fi hotspots so that those that don't have great internet connectivity will be able to go to the community center, be able to go to the library, be able to go to the park and do some ongoing learning along the way there. And that's going to be really key to what we've got to do. And as well, we're going to have wired connections, which will be paid for, so kids know that they can continue learning online. Those are for those kids who can't get the class, don't feel comfortable getting the class. And it's also going to be part of our educational mix going forward, because I think you're going to find online learning is a complement to what's going on in the classroom. That said, there are a lot of kids that didn't do very well with online learning in the last cycle. 25% according to our surveys, 30% to some of what the teachers have told us, just didn't learn very well. We're learning from that. It was not simply a matter of connectivity, but sometimes it was lack of parental understanding, parental support, parental supervision, or lack of student interest. How to get learning online in a cohesive way is something that still takes work. We're going to do a lot better on it this time around than last time. Remote learners did learn significantly less in school than, less remotely than they did in the classroom. Something of real concern to me, and I hear this a lot, is, one in six Connecticut students had family or health or trauma or other related reasons why they had to get to the classroom other home life obstacles that were distracting for them. And you hear from our Department of Children and Families that sometimes these kids get to the classroom and you get a lot of feedback in terms of what's going on in home life. And that's sometimes how we're able to monitor the safety of the situation there. Other reasons we think getting back to the classroom is so important. Finally, I can tell you that we have our 211 hotline. The American Association of Pediatrics have all talked about depression and a sense of isolation. We had have a great guy from United Way, Rick Porth, and whenever we did our unified command of all the commissioners, he'd always tell us the calls coming in to 211, and so many of them were related to young people who just had a sense of isolation. These are all the reasons that we're trying to encourage people to get back to the classroom, but only if we can do it safely. And finally, the CDC, a lot of kids, their main meal comes from the classroom, or their main meal comes from getting to school. So the school provides a whole variety of broader services. Anyway, we can get kids back to school. We can do distance learning. A lot of it's related to behavior. Connecticut's done very well because we have managed the behavior well. We've been wearing the mask. We've done the social distancing. But not everybody has. And this next chart tells you, Be Smart Connecticut. And what it says is, if you can see the headline, we're partying too much, says Gina Raimondo. A lot of parties in the state of Rhode Island, our next door neighbor, they have spiked up a little bit. It's disconcerting. It's not just the flare-ups in Florida or Texas, but they're now flare-ups next door to us in Rhode Island. A lot of those related to parties by young people. Phil Murphy, the governor of New Jersey, a little more colorful than your governor, I'm afraid. He says COVID-19 clusters from massive New Jersey house parties belong to the Knucklehead Hall of Fame. And this is why it is so important that you parents are there explaining to your kids every day why we're not doing this as punishment. You're maintaining these protocols. You're wearing the mask. You're not going to these big type parties where the infections are spiking up. And I'm not picking on New Jersey and Rhode Island. We've had some of these parties ourselves, and we're watching it like a hawk. This next chart sort of tells you what has changed and what's happening here. These are new cases by age. And just very quickly, I can tell you the biggest spike in new cases, Zeke, is related to those ages 10 to 19. In the last week, the number of people in that age group who tested positive has doubled. And 20 to 29-year-olds, the Gen Z generation, is gone up dramatically as well. Zeke, the baby boomers, you and I, we have not gone up as much. But this is why it is so important we keep an eye on these young parties where so much of the risk can take place. Look, with that, I really want to reintroduce to you Zeke Emanuel. Zeke has been obviously an advisor for us informally over the last few months, certainly. He was on, I think, 6-plus weeks ago with Scott. And here's an update to say, how are we doing so far? Your observations on Connecticut reopening in general, reopening the schools. And we've talked a bit about what you're learning internationally and what we can learn from their example. Zeke Emanuel.
Thank you, Governor. It's a pleasure to be back, and I certainly hope that I can be helpful in shedding some light on this very important issue. Let me tell you how I think about education. I'm an educator. I'm a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and so I take education very seriously. I do think we need to think of primary and secondary schooling as essential. It's kind of like as important, especially in the 21st century, as food and nutrition. And as the governor said, there are a myriad of reasons why it's absolutely essential for children. Educational attainment, we know online's not as good, especially for younger kids. Socialization, so children don't feel isolated and alone. All those social services that school are connected to, whether it's meals, monitoring for abuse, providing a safe place for students to be. And the last one, of course, is it's hard to get parents to be fully productive if they're at home caring for their kids, cleaning the house, and serving as teachers' aides. So for a whole variety of reasons, I think schooling is important. When can you open schooling? And I think the governor was right. We recommended in our article that you have a combination of two metrics, low transmission rate in your community and a low test positivity rate, indicating that you're testing enough and you're not finding lots of hidden cases. How do you get to a low transmission rate? The exact way that Connecticut has done it. And, you know, you close non-essential businesses, you reopen them outdoors to minimize the indoor time, you physically distance, you have universal mask wearing. We know this works. We can see it in other countries, and we can see it in the states like Connecticut that have implemented this conscientiously. Let's be clear. We're not the pioneers here. Many other countries have opened their schools and opened their schools relatively well. You know, just a brief list include the Netherlands, New Zealand, Denmark, Norway, Finland, Singapore, Taiwan, Austria, Belgium. We're not alone here. Almost all those countries have been able to do it without flare-ups. A few countries, when they opened up high schools, had flare-ups. I know a lot of you are thinking about Israel. It is the exception, not the rule. You have many countries that have opened up without seeing a rise in cases. Israel, the opening of schools, was associated with the rise of cases. But, and let me emphasize a but, there are two problems with drawing too much conclusion from that. First, many things were changing at the same time. And as a recent report concluded about Israel, it said, a clear causal role for schools in this resurgence, however, has not been demonstrated, mainly because many other things were changing. The second point is that Israel did not prepare in any way with the near thoroughness that Connecticut is approaching this topic. They did not institute precautions such as face mask wearing, hand hygiene in the classroom, distancing, and the other measures. In addition, they sent kids back to places that weren't prepared with the public health measures we know. They went back to very crowded classrooms. Israel has got notoriously crowded high schools, and they did not de-densify. So when we think about opening schools, let me say we need to attend to every part. And again, I think and commend Connecticut for doing this. The transportation to school. You know, we know that a lot of kids are going to walk, ride their bike, or be driven by their family. Some kids have to take a school bus. How do we de-risk that? Well, we reduce the number of kids on the bus, so each kid has his own seat and hopefully separated by another spare seat. You open the windows to keep airflow high. In the classroom, again, think about universal mask wearing. Think about distancing. There's attention to meals. How are we going to get students nutritious meals without crowding in the cafeteria to make sure that they don't infect the healthcare workers and that they actually don't crowd around together? You're going to have changes in athletics. Indoor contact sports just not going to be possible under these circumstances. And then you need to rethink extracurricular activities. Even with all these precautions in place, it's quite clear that not every parent is going to be comfortable. And that we understand. And it should be an option for them. In that regard, Connecticut is not going to be unique. Every country that opened up, there are a group of parents who are nervous. They don't want to be the first ones. They want to be sure that all the safeguards are in place, that the various kinks are being ironed out. Other parents recognize schooling's importance, the important role of being in person, the importance of the social activity for child development, and they want their kids to go. You have to have an option for those who are worried or simply cannot go to school because of other concerns in the house or because of health. And in that result, again, Connecticut stands out for preparing, providing students with computers, providing hotspots so every kid can get high-speed internet and actually do their work. This is a, as I, let me conclude with the way I began. Education is essential. It's not optional in the 21st century. We need an educated student body and an educated workforce. We've got to get people back. And Connecticut is in a perfect place to open up its schools, given its low transmission rate and low test positivity rate. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Well, thank you, Zeke. And Josh and Paul are here as well. Over to you, Max.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, you know, touching on the Be Smart Connecticut initiative, we've been hearing of several cases where people might be getting careless when it comes to wearing the mask in public places, for example, outside in West Hartford Center, other downtown places. Do you expect to issue an executive order requiring people to wear masks in public areas?
Right now, you're required to wear a mask in public areas all the time indoors, and all the time outdoors if you can't socially distance, if you can't keep at least 6 feet. And if you think we have to be stronger on enforcing that, we're going to enforce that because we can't allow these flare-ups to continue.
And I'd like to touch really briefly on the topic of the police accountability bill. You know, we did an unscientific poll. 92% of our viewers didn't think that you should sign it. Are you seeing that type of pushback on your end? And what do you say to those people who are against this?
Well, I'd love to know what the question you asked them was. Did you ask them whether you think we ought to have more transparency and accountability when it comes to our police force? Did you say our police force has acted brilliantly, I would say, in most cases, in and around the protests following George Floyd, but that doesn't preclude the fact we ought to be able to hold people accountable? Did you tell them that we kept qualified immunity in place for all but the most egregious of crimes? I think you'll find people understand that the legislature made the right call.
News 8. NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor. The districts were told to come up with multiple plans and spent the summer making them, now to be told that they need to pick their plans instead of the state making the decision. Some educators are criticizing that, calling it a cop-out, saying that you don't want to take the heat, so you're pushing it onto the local districts to decide. Just wanted to get your response to that criticism.
The other 90% of superintendents say give me more flexibility. So we're trying to thread that needle by saying, here are the guidelines, how you can open your schools safely. Assuming the metrics are in a good place, this is how you open it for in-person learning plus a mix of hybrid. And if the metrics go in a different direction, this is when you should be closing your school.
What's your reaction to the teachers' rallies taking place across the state today?
That was a little ironic. I was meeting with the Connecticut Education Association, probably 20 teachers around the table. We had a very constructive conversation for an hour or so, and everybody had to leave to go do a car rally around my residence and house. But we had a good constructive conversation, and I think it's important that the teachers be involved in the decision-making.
And my last question regarding Eversource, lawmakers called for a peer investigation and a hearing. Have you had any contact with Eversource? Are you going to be taking any part in this?
I'm hearing it.
Reminder for everyone on the call to please mute your devices. Please mute your devices.
That sounds muted. Yeah, I got to tell you, our regulatory body that takes a look at electric utility rate increases is going to be taking a good hard look at the Eversource rate increase. You know, this current rate increase, by the way, is about 4%. About half of that is related to what the feds have ordered all the states across the country to do. I see that the attorney generals, Senator Blumenthal and William Tong, are challenging that, and I can understand why they're doing it. And along the way, everybody got a big electric bill last week. And much of that is related to the fact that you were home, it was incredibly hot, air conditions were on, and I think electric usage was up something like 35%. So we're gonna do everything we can to help you have the room to make the payments necessary to do, provide you the energy efficiency that you need so we can hold down those electric bills going forward. all at the same time taking a look at that Eversource rate increase.
Thank you.
Fox 61.
Hi, Governor. Some teachers specifically don't feel comfortable being while teaching come fall because, one, privacy concerns, and two, they say it will be difficult catering to those inside the classroom and those online at the same time. Can you address those concerns?
I got most of that. I think the complication of having a number of kids who are online plus catering in the classroom. I'll start with this, and maybe somebody can help me. What I've heard from other states that have done this well is they've tried to have a real synchronous online connection between kids at home and kids in the classroom. So it's not just an academic exercise you have at home, but there's also some social interaction, be it remotely, with the kids in the classroom. And that means that teachers are teaching the same way to the kids remotely as well as to the kids in the classroom. And it's also, we thought a lot about those teachers that probably have a pre-existing condition or of a certain age where they shouldn't be in the classroom. Perhaps they can teach remotely, and you'd have an apprentice teacher in the classroom to help support the kids who are there. Any other thoughts on that, anybody? That's it.
WTIC 1080 News.
Dr. Emanuel Rump said indoor contact sports were not possible. Of course, everyone has a question about the most popular outdoor contact sport, which is football. Is that possible this fall?
Hey, Zeke, the question was whether football can be played this fall.
I don't think so. I think that's, we recommend, if you look at our risk graphic, that contact sports of any type not be played. I understand, and believe me, I had I was a debater. Debate was a crucial part of my life. I was a swimmer, crucial part of my life. I understand giving up something that is a crucial part of your life. But we do need to be safe and put safety number one. And I think contact sports are not a good idea. NFL is going to try it with a bubble. You can't have a bubble in high school. You have transportation. You have lots of things which are going to complicate having a football season. I think, for 1 year, we're probably going to have to take a miss on it.
On the phone right now to update us on what still has not happened, has or hasn't happened, the saga, the modern-day saga. This has to be the most interesting Columbus statue saga going in the continental U.S. right now, I would gather. Chris Caruso is with us. Chris, hi. How are you, sir?
Hey, Paul. How's everything going?
I'm all right. Chris, I'm guessing that this probably, I don't think there's a match for this around the country right now. There was a park commission meeting. Now, you were just going into it yesterday when we chatted by email. Did I sense this is a kick the can down the road a little more? What's up here with the statue?
Well, I think you put it the right way. It was kicking the can down the road. What the park board decided to do was to give it 30 more days of discussion, and then at their September meeting, which is usually I think the second Wednesday of the month, then they would decide whether the statue would be returned to its pedestal or whether it would be kept down, indefinitely. We as Italian Americans are more than willing to discuss and continue the dialogue. However, I think we've made it clear to the park board that no matter what comes of the discussion, the Columbus statue has to be restored. So the Columbus statue is part of any discussion, any final deal, any negotiations. And, Paul, I marvel at one thing, that this has really unified the Italian-American community, especially in Bridgeport and the greater Bridgeport community. Before Garibaldi brought together the various kingdoms, if you will, of the different territories in Italy, they were all separated out. So you had the Sicilians, you had the Romans, mm-hmm. you had, the Abruzzi community and so forth. And when they came to Italy, they pretty much came that segregated parts of Italy. they brought it into the United States as well. And the Columbus statue has unified the Italian community squarely behind the Columbus statue itself, that it has to be restored. And when I say unanimous, I say unanimous. You know, I run into Italians of many walks of life, and it's unanimous that they want the statue to be returned and the respect, continued for the Italian-American community. So, yeah, we'll wait another 30 days, and we're more than willing to engage in continued dialogue. But it has to be that statue becomes part of the final resolution, if you will.
What was the tenor of the meeting last night, Chris? What was it like? Was it heated? Was it cordial? Were there substantive discussions? I know, meetings are meetings, some things are private, but what was it like?
Well, it was interesting. You know, the public wasn't allowed to speak. We could listen, or you could get into the Zoom where, you'd have a photo of yourself, but you weren't allowed to really discuss it. I thought overall the demeanor of the conversations last night by the Park Commission was very amicable. There was no tension or anything of that sort. One commissioner who's already made up her mind did state publicly that, "I don't mind talking to people, but I've already made up my mind that the statue should come down." And then there was one commissioner who, at the final resolution, did not vote along with everyone else to continue the dialogue. He said that the statue should be restored and then continue the dialogue. So it wasn't unanimous action. There was actually one member, as I mentioned, who said, "No, restore the statue first and then continue the dialogue." And I think he heard really what we've been saying as an Italian-American community. If you don't restore the statue, technically the protesters have won. They met their objective, which was to take the statue down. And then, in effect, you're tying the hands of the Italian community. We'd be pushing that stone, that proverbial stone, up the side of a mountain. And once we get it to the top, it would come back down on us. So, we have to have a fair and honest discussion and a sharing of opinions to decide the fate of the statue. We've been saying that right along. So, frankly, the next 30 days, I don't know how the discussions will start up again. I don't know who will be at the table. The commissioners talked about the community, and that's pretty large. So we don't know, but we are ready and willing to continue the dialogue. But again, as we've said to the Park Board and we've said publicly, the restoration of the statue must be part of whatever resolution is met. We're not going to stand by and let the statue just be taken down and us put our tails between our legs and walk away. We're not going to do that. We're going to oppose this, this issue of taking the statues down. We believe in very meaningful dialogue. The Italian community is part of Bridgeport. It helped to build Bridgeport over the years. And we're just not going to be relegated to, second status in the city. So, you remember those shows with your TV dinners, As the World Turns, General yes. Hospital. I think it's As the World Turns, that again. And you're probably right, Paul, when you compare us to other cities in the state. The dialogue is continuing, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. I think that's where we are at this point. And, hopefully it can be resolved. We want resolution, too. We've been, as Italian-Americans, we've been discussing this for about 3 months now, and we all have other things in our lives to do, but we feel it's important. One of the commissioners asked me, not on the radio, but, or not in the meeting, I should say, asked me, what it means to Columbus. And I said, well, you've got to be Italian to understand it. And it's really part of our uprising. It's part of our breeding, I should say, when we're mm-hmm. born and we're raised in the Italian family. It's part of the Italian experience. And, many outside of the Italian community have said, well, why don't you pick a more deserving Italian? And, that's insulting because, frankly, I don't say to the Puerto Rican community, why don't you pick a more recognizable or more a deserving Puerto Rican? I don't say that to the Black community, and I wouldn't say that to the Polish community. It's insulting. Each community has to decide who they would like to honor. And again, the full story of Columbus is not being told, because those who are screaming the loudest are talking about their interpretation of history. You know, it was a very interesting article and letter to the editor by a former city councilman in Bridgeport, mm-hmm. Thomas Mulligan.
Mm-hmm.
And he raised the issue, which is very true. The native Indians in Puerto Rico had massacred 42 Spaniards who were left there by Columbus. Columbus had left. He came back in a year. They were massacred, and it was cannibalistic. And mm-hmm. so, you know, the argument is, well, let's put a statue up to the indigenous people, and in particular the native Indians of Puerto Rico. Well, they are just as bad, if you will, as you're accusing Columbus of. And you know, I've always said to people, you can't judge a 15th century explorer by 21st century standards. It's impossible to do it. And there's been professors, history professors. There's a tape going around, a 45-minute video, as a matter of fact, from a history professor that paints an entirely different picture of Columbus based on historic facts.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
You know, I think that's what's troubling to me.
That's exactly what I mentioned yesterday, Chris, is that we're trying to and I'm willing to listen to all arguments in this. We're trying to evaluate somebody who lived hundreds of years ago in a vastly different world, where tragically some things that we would never think of accepting today were accepted by some people as just, well, a fact of life. So it will be interesting. Chris Caruso, thank you. We'll keep in touch with you on this, and maybe in a month we will know more. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, appreciate it. All right, there you go. So another month, folks, kept you updated on the Columbus statue. Still down, still in storage. The Parks Commission going to meet next month, so there will be another listening period to see what happens. And I'm glad Chris ended on that, because as you recall in the final hour yesterday, I said, listen, bad things are bad things. We understand that. Slavery now, is as bad as slavery was 300 years ago, is as bad as it was 1,000 years ago. Physical, you know, a physical assault on someone doesn't change over time. But what does change, thankfully getting better, is the overall acceptance of what happens. And oftentimes you look at people like Columbus and other historical figures, and you see some of the things they've done, maybe yes, maybe some of these things were egregious, who knows. But sometimes you have to evaluate history in the time that it happened. That doesn't take away from what happened. But again, you know, looking at stuff 2020 with 2020 vision in the year 2020 on July 30th, well, you know, it's a little different than looking at it 25, 50, 75, 100, 200 years ago. And again, you know, I talk to people about this all the time. And as Chris said, there's a what's the big deal with Columbus? And again, as he has said, and either you understand this or you understand where he's coming from on this or you don't. And I can say this as an Italian-American, too. The Columbus statue is tied into an ethnicity, a lineage. Now, you may think that's dumb. Okay, fine. You can think it's dumb. But that's the bottom line. It is.